Hello and welcome to the November 2015 IFRIC Update podcast. My name is Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities at the ISB, and I'm joined today by Javed Dasani, April Pittman and Bernadette Wittick to talk about some of the issues that the Interpretations Committee discussed at its November meeting. Now, the views that you'll hear today will be those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the IFRS Interpretations Committee or the ISB. Now, the Interpretations Committee met on the 10th and 11th of November and discussed several issues, three of which we're going to take a look at today. Now, the first of these related to IS16 property, plant and equipment and IS38 intangible assets, and was the question about the accounting for variable payments for asset purchases. Now, Javed, this is an issue where discussions have been ongoing for quite a while. Can you tell us a little bit about the background and history of this project?
Yes, definitely. Thanks, Michael. So the Interpretations Committee had originally received a request to address the accounting for variable payments for asset purchases outside of a business combination. They discussed this issue over several meetings between 2011 and 2013. When they discussed it at that time, they could not reach a consensus on whether variable payments that were dependent on the purchaser's future activity actually met the definition of a liability until that activity had occurred. Also, because the accounting for variable payments was being considered by the ISB as part of its projects, which were the leases and the conceptual framework projects, the committee decided it would be best to put the issue on hold until these discussions were completed and until the re-deliberations on the leases exposure draft had been finalized. So subsequently, once those discussions were completed, the committee revisited this issue at its meeting in September and lastly in November 2015.
Okay, and what were the Interpretation Committee members' observations at this meeting? Have they been able to reach a consensus on these issues?
Yes, so again, when they discussed this issue again in September and November, the sticking point was that they could not reach a consensus on whether variable payments that depended on the purchase of future activity, whether those met the recognition criteria for a liability until that activity had actually occurred, and also if it did meet the criteria for recognition, what the measurement of that liability should be.
And I suppose at the heart of the debate about does the liability exist comes down to the fact that these are liabilities that are dependent on the purchaser's future activity. So therefore, is it in the control of the purchaser?
Absolutely.
And how does that interact with the definition of a financial liability in IS 32?
Absolutely. That was the crux of the issue on whether something that's in the control of the purchaser is a financial liability or not. And they looked at the various pieces of guidance in IS 37 and financial instruments, conceptual framework. They also looked at the additional concept that are now being proposed in the definition of a liability in the exposure draft of the conceptual framework. And they also noted that during its deliberations of the proposals in the leases exposure draft and now the final guidance, forthcoming guidance on leases, members of the ISB had expressed mixed views on whether variable payments linked to future performance or use of the underlying asset in a lease contract met the definition of a liability. Some ISB members thought that such payments met the definition of a liability, while others thought that they did not meet the definition of a liability. And the Interpretation Committee noted that the ISB did not actually conclude on whether these met the definition of a liability when they developed their proposals for variable payments in lease contracts.
So what has the committee decided to do with this issue now?
So in the November meeting, the Interpretations Committee observed that this issue is too broad for them to address within the confines of existing IFRS. Consequently, they've tentatively decided not to add this issue onto its agenda. And as you will see in the IFRIC update from the November meeting, they have issued a tentative agenda decision. That agenda decision is open for comments till January 21st. Of 2016.
And the committee will look at the comments it receives on that at the March 2016
Absolutely,
meeting.
Absolutely, that is the expectation at this stage.
Okay, thank you. Our next issue relates to the accounting for long-term supply contracts and prepayments. Now, April, can you just remind us about what the issue is on this one?
Yes, the Interpretations Committee received a request to clarify the accounting for long-term supply contracts when the purchaser agrees to make significant prepayments to the supplier. The question considered was whether the purchaser should accrete interest on the long-term prepayments by recognising interest income, and that would result in an increase in the cost of inventories and ultimately the cost of sales. Now, IAS 2 already contains a clear requirement in paragraph 18 that purchases on deferred settlement terms, that is, accrued costs rather than prepaid costs, should recognise an interest expense. And there are a number of references in IFRS, such as IAS 38 intangible assets and IAS 16 property, plant and equipment, that require an interest charge reflected separately when there are deferred settlement terms. The guidance in IFRS 15, Revenue from Contracts with Customers, is also relevant to the question. That standard requires that if a contract contains a significant financing component, it should be reported separately as interest income or expense. Consequently, the Interpretations Committee think that it's clear that if a long-term supply contract contains a significant financing component, whether deferred or prepaid, that financing component of the transaction should be recognised separately.
So what did our outreach tell us about this?
Now, when we conducted the original outreach on this issue, we found that some entities adjusted the contract price for financing arrangements and others did not, and that was taken to be evidence of diversity in practice. But we had no information about whether the transactions considered in that outreach had a financing component that should have been presented separately, or whether they did not contain a financing component and consequently no adjustment was required. We think that if the reported diversity arose because there were two different types of arrangements, the different outcomes are explained by the different facts and circumstances in the underlying transaction. Now, we tried to collect more evidence about the nature of individual supply contracts involving long-term prepayment. We wanted to conduct outreach that would enable us to draw out how we distinguish in each transaction whether the arrangement has a financing component or whether the purchaser made the prepayment for other reasons. We were only able to identify one such entity, and we had a detailed discussion with that respondent. The entity was a European preparer in a high technology sector. The entity entered into these long-term contracts with the supplier in order to secure its future supplies of silicon, which was then in scarce supply. The entity did not accrete interest on the prepayments.
So where does this take us to now?
Well, Michael, on such a small sample, the Interpretations Committee was unable to draw conclusions about whether this type of transaction is widespread, whether it's diversity in practice, or whether that diversity originally identified is due to there being two types of long-term contracts, one type that contains a financing component and another that doesn't, or whether the effect of recognising any financing component separately as interest would be material to the entity.
So how's the Interpretations Committee decided to conclude on this?
Well, in the absence of evidence about the issue and details of the facts and circumstances relating to these transactions, it was difficult really to see how the Interpretations Committee could address this topic efficiently and effectively. And consequently, the Interpretations Committee decided at its November meeting that the issue did not meet its agenda criteria and decided to remove the topic from its agenda.
Okay, thank you. Our third issue relates to IAS 32 and financial instruments presentation, and in particular to the offsetting and cash pooling arrangements that some companies have. Now, Bernadette, could you briefly describe the issue, please?
Yeah, so the issue relates to whether certain types of cash pooling arrangements would meet the requirements for offsetting under IAS 32. And the submitter described a very particular type of cash pooling arrangement between a number of subsidiaries within a group, each of which had legally separate bank accounts. And the arrangement already met the requirements regarding the legal right of offset set out in paragraph 42A of IAS 32. And the group also regularly instigated physical transfer of balances into a single netting account, but this transfer didn't take place at the reporting date. So also another key feature of the arrangement was that the period end balances may actually change prior to the next physical settlement date, as group entities may place further cash on deposit or withdraw cash to settle other obligations. And so with this fact pattern in mind, the submitter asked whether the arrangement would be sufficient to demonstrate an intention to settle net in accordance with paragraph 42b of IAS 32, and identified two alternative views regarding that accounting treatment. So the first view was that the regular practice was sufficient to demonstrate an intention to the regular practice of a physical transfer into a single account was sufficient to demonstrate the intention to settle on a net basis. And the second view was that that regular practice wouldn't have been sufficient to demonstrate that intention, because the positive and negative cash balances will rise and fall in line with the cash requirements of individual subsidiaries within the group.
So there was quite a bit of focus on the actual balances at the end of the period and whether
that's
those
correct.
Would be settled by
that's,
offset.
That's correct. And it's not about the actual balances having an ability to move. It was the fact that they may have been settled in a different way other than by net settlement.
Yes. Okay.
And that was the key difference there.
Okay. Yeah. Now, what do we know about how widespread the issue is and what diversity in practice there might be?
Yeah, so in terms of whether the issue is widespread, the overall feedback suggested that while cash pooling arrangements in general were quite common, the specific type of cash pooling arrangement described by the submitter was not actually that common. But we also noted that there was a number of different types of cash pooling arrangements in existence, and also that entities that often didn't disclose the particular types of arrangements they were involved in. In terms of diversity, we did get an indication that there was mixed practice in terms of the predominant accounting treatment, but it was difficult to say really, because it wasn't always clear what the exact type of cash pooling arrangement they were commenting on, and in many cases it didn't seem to be the same fact pattern as that which was presented by the submitter.
So what was the committee's view on this?
So the committee discussed the requirements of IAS 32, and in particular they focused on paragraphs 46 and 47. And that's where it's noted that presentation, net presentation, only more appropriately affects the timings of expected future cash flows when you have not only a legal right to set off, but also this intention to exercise that right. And they also noted that when determining whether or not you had that intention, an entity should consider the normal business practices, the requirements of financial markets and other circumstances that may limit the ability to settle net. So in the light of that guidance then, the committee observed that in the example presented, because the entity doesn't expect to settle the period end balances on a net basis due to the expected future activity prior to the next settlement date, it wouldn't be appropriate for the entity to assert that it had the intention to settle the entire period end balances on a net basis. However, the committee did acknowledge that there may be other circumstances where judgment perhaps would be required. And overall, their conclusion was that there was sufficient guidance within IFRS regarding how an entity might determine whether it had the intention to settle on a net basis in accordance with IAS 32, and consequently, the tentative decision was to not add this issue onto its agenda.
So what are the next steps now for this project?
So the next steps for this project are that the decision, the tentative agenda decision is open for comment for 60 days. Until January, and then the Interpretations Committee will discuss the comments received at a future meeting.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of the IFRIC Update podcast for November 2015. As a reminder, the full details of the meeting can be found in the IFRIC Update newsletter. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.